The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello, and welcome to Short Circuit, your podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeals. I'm your host, Anthony Sanders, Director of the Center for Judicial Engagement at the Institute for Justice. We're recording this on Thursday, April 28th, 2022. And that means we're just 3 weeks away from our forum on judicial engagement and the Michigan Constitution. If you live in the state of Michigan and would like to learn more about your state's constitution and also about judicial engagement and what we do at IJ, then please come join us. It's Friday, May 20th, 2022 at noon at the Inn at St. John's in Plymouth, Michigan, which is basically near Detroit and Ann Arbor. We have a bunch of speakers discussing the Michigan Constitution, including retired Justice Stephen Markman. It's free, and there's even a free lunch. It's the latest in our series of forums on judicial engagement and specific state constitutions. You may remember we had one in Georgia a couple months ago. Earlier than that, we had one for Pennsylvania, and we started things off a couple years ago in Minnesota. If you want to come, please RSVP, and you can find a link to do that in our show notes or at our webpage at ij.org. Today, though, it's all First Amendment, all the time. First, we're going to look at why it might be that if you're sued to prevent you from speaking, so someone sues you to stop you from speaking, you might nevertheless not have any reason to fear the law you were sued under. It sounds strange, but that's what the Eighth Circuit said last week. Also, we get into some speech drama in the Oregon legislature. Oregon might not always represent the chill left coast haven that it's made out to be, as the Ninth Circuit recently detailed. Joining us to exercise their First Amendment rights are, first, IJ Law and Liberty Fellow Tori Clark. Welcome back, Tori.
Thanks for having me.
And IJ's greatest beard grower, attorney Sam Gedge. Sam, welcome back.
Thank you, Anthony.
Well, Tori, this is a case kind of near and dear to my heart because it talks about a newspaper, the City Pages, that in college I would sit in coffee shops and flip through it and look at all the shows and theater openings that I could go to. And now it doesn't exist anymore. But this case has nothing to do with my theater habits, but everything to do about what you might read in other parts of the City Pages that I never took any notice of. So, Tori, tell us the story.
Yeah, absolutely. So this case is called Christian Action League of Minnesota versus Freeman out of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. And this case is super interesting for several reasons, but sort of at standing on its own, it illustrates the lengths to which courts will sometimes go to get rid of a case on procedural grounds and avoid answering, you know, important constitutional questions. So this case, as you mentioned, kind of arises out of a dispute about advertisements in a newspaper. So the parties here, the original parties, were a private individual and an advocacy group called the Christian Action League, or CAL. And CAL specifically targeted sexually oriented businesses and publications. And one of those publications that CAL targeted, as you mentioned, was a Minneapolis newspaper publication called City Pages. And City Pages, like you said, ran advertisements for lots of different companies, but some of those companies were sexually oriented businesses. And because of that, CAL targeted other businesses who also advertised in City Pages, because CAL believed that anyone who advertised alongside the sexually oriented businesses was like tacitly endorsing those businesses. So out of City Pages, one of CAL's targets was a lawyer named R. Lee Frost. And Frost ran an advertisement for her firm in City Pages. And after that, CAL sent her a charming postcard that basically said, how can you sleep at night because City Pages promotes porn and you advertise in City Pages. So basically, you're promoting porn and how can you live with yourself as a woman? CAL then followed up with another postcard and an email expressing similar sentiments. And after that, Frost asked CAL to stop contacting her. But then about a week later, CAL sent her a third postcard. So that third postcard was the straw that broke the camel's back, apparently, and Frost sought a restraining order against Cal under a Minnesota state statute that allows victims of harassment to obtain a restraining order against their harasser. So an astute observer might wonder, are three non-threatening postcards and an email really harassment? Which is a good question, and we'll come back to it. But the state court evidently agreed with Frost at that point that Cal's behavior was harassment under the statute. It entered a restraining order against Cal that, if Cal had violated it, would have carried criminal penalties. And then after a few months, Frost and Cal came to a settlement agreement and the restraining order was dissolved. So after the state suit was over, Cal sued sued Minnesota state officials in federal court and argued that the anti-harassment statute under which the restraining order was entered was unconstitutional because, among other reasons, it hampered their First Amendment right to free speech. But the federal trial court dismissed the case, in part because it concluded that Cal didn't have standing to challenge the statute. And just as a quick refresher, the idea of standing basically requires a claimant in a case to be actually injured or very likely to be injured about by something before they can sue about that thing. So the trial court in this case concluded that Cal wasn't injured and wasn't likely to be injured and therefore didn't have standing because Cal's conduct was not harassment under the statute, and therefore the statute couldn't possibly hurt Cal. And, you know, it so ruled, even though, again, the statute had actually been applied to Cal in the state suit. And a panel of the Eighth Circuit over a dissent agreed with the trial court. And the majority opinion turns on the issue of whether Cal's conduct was actually, again, harassment under the statute. And the court acknowledged at the outset that the text of the statute was ambiguous, that they couldn't tell from the face of the statute whether it actually applied to Cal's conduct. And there was no case law from the Minnesota Supreme Court either way on that either. But nonetheless, the Eighth Circuit resorted to some intermediate courts of appeals decisions and some more general principles of statutory interpretation to conclude that Cal's behavior didn't fall under the statute's purview. But as the dissent in this case points out, that outcome doesn't make sense for several reasons. First and foremost, again, the statute had already been applied to Cal's behavior, so we don't have to guess about whether the statute would ever apply to that behavior or whether Cal would ever be injured by the statute, because Cal was actually injured by the statute in the exact circumstance based on the exact same facts that Cal was suing about. And the majority opinion tries to get around this by saying, well, it was only the private individual, Frost, who enforced the statute against Cal and not the state defendants that Cal ultimately sued. But, you know, at least on my read of the statute, you know, there is no mechanism for government officials to go after harassers directly. So it's not even clear that the government would be able to do this thing that, you know, the Eighth Circuit is saying Cal would need them to do in order to have standing to challenge the statute. And, you know, on a more fundamental level, you know, you can't bring constitutional challenges to statutes against private individuals because the Constitution only limits the power of the government. So under the majority's interpretation of the statute, basically, someone could, you know, seek the government's power to enter a restraining order against you. That restraining order could restrict your conduct in your life, but you still can't bring a constitutional challenge against it because it's not the government who's actually enforcing that order or enforcing the statute. Now, there is a scenario in which someone could create standing perhaps on this set of facts. For instance, if they got an order entered against them, violated that order, and then subjected themselves to potential criminal liability. But that raises its own set of issues, right? And, you know, students of standing will know that there's a lot of case law on that. And the majority doesn't even engage with any of this. It just kind of glosses it over and doesn't really discuss it all that much. So that's the first big bucket of issues there. The second problem with the majority opinion on a more technical level is that the Supreme Court has already said that a claimant has standing in this kind of case when their conduct is even arguably prescribed by the statute in question. So if you remember, the majority started its analysis by saying the statute was ambiguous about whether it applied to Cal's behavior. And that probably should have ended the analysis, because if the statute is ambiguous, then the statute arguably prescribes Cal's behavior, which gives Cal standing. And again, this is consistent with what happened in the real world, because the statute was actually applied to Cal. So, you know, whatever you think about Cal's tactics, agree, disagree, you know, this is really a case about when can someone sue to protect their constitutional rights. And, you know, the statute, again, was actually enforced against Cal, but then two federal courts in a row said, well, sorry, the statute might not actually apply to you, so you don't even get the chance to try to vindicate your constitutional rights. So, you know, that's what happened here. I think there's probably some other things going on under the surface. You know, some, again, like more astute observers will look at this. And this case, actually, the Eighth Circuit case, was submitted just 4 days after Whole Woman's Health came out in the Supreme Court. So there's probably some of that going on. But, you know, in terms of like on the face of the opinion, you know, the Eighth Circuit really, really does actually say there's this statute and you can't sue even though you were hurt by it.
Yeah. And they cite Whole Woman's Health even near the end.
They do, yeah. And they say, like I said earlier, they said, well, you know, you can't sue about the statute because it's only a private person who's enforcing it. But at least on my understanding of it, in Whole Woman's Health, there was no possibility of any kind of criminal penalty. It was all civil liability. And here, the restraining order, if you violated it, did subject you to criminal penalties. And depending on the exact circumstances of that violation, it could even be a felony to violate that order. So, you know, the court did, again, like kind of cite Whole Woman's Health, but it didn't really grapple with like the real issues and the real substance, in my opinion, of what Whole Woman's Health said.
Well, Sam, you, unlike most constitutional lawyers, have actually litigated private parties enforcing state laws and whether there are constitutional issues with that. So what's your spin on all these tribulations of what you read in the defunct city pages?
Yeah, no, you're right, Anthony. So IJ had a case a few years ago in Colorado. And at the time, Colorado had a really bizarre system of private party enforcement for really baroque campaign finance laws. Basically, the state outsourced to whoever wanted to kind of harass their political opponent the power to basically bring the full power of the state against them for any kind of penny anti-campaign finance violation. We didn't end up kind of getting into the rat's nest that these folks in the Eighth Circuit did, because the Secretary of State, who was in fact a state actor, was an integral part of the, at least a ministerial part of the enforcement mechanism. So we had a government official we could sue, which was great, because we ended up winning, and that system is no longer in place in Colorado. But more broadly, I mean, my initial reaction to this case was that it's like the rare First Amendment case where the least annoying participant is the government, right? Because this nonprofit, they like bless them for their exercising their First Amendment rights. Like, they seem super annoying. This lawyer seems like really trigger happy and apparently was filing a restraining order despite binding Intermediate Court precedent saying she couldn't do it. And I don't know. I don't really like either of those, you know, parties. But my general thinking is, you know, if this nonprofit had the stomach to have this fight and raise these First Amendment issues, like, why didn't they just do it in the state court action when they were actually part of a live lawsuit? There would have been no question that they could have raised this as a defense when the lawyer sued them in state court, and they could have presumably could have won under that binding Intermediate Court precedent in Minnesota. So it just befuddles me a little bit why they would settle that case and then wait a year and then sue a local prosecutor who, it sounds like, sincerely had zero interest in prosecuting them in the first place. So, you know, maybe the answer is that it's they didn't have a lawyer who's willing to represent them the first time around. They did the second time around. But struck me as kind of just a weird situation where it's not really kind of clear why people were having this fight to begin with.
Yeah, I'm guessing the federal case, that they have their ducks more in a row in making a federal case out of it and a First Amendment case out of it. But it is, I mean, even though I guess it would have been good if they brought that First Amendment defense in the state action against this private party. It is something that the majority completely ignores, is that not just that this, you know, one wildcat person brought this claim that they don't think even was allowed under state law, but a court ruled in her favor. Now, it was an ex parte TRO, so there was no one on the other side. It was just, you know, courts often grant that, especially when it doesn't seem like there's going to be a lot of prejudice by entering that order. But still, that state judge thought that this law was okay and applied, not just was constitutional, but applied to this set of facts. And for the majority to just, you know, blithely brush that aside is quite extraordinary, as it seems like the dissent thinks. It seems like they have a little better argument about Mike Freeman, who is a long time county attorney in Hennepin and has been sued many, 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 many times in his career. And this, you know, little lawsuit, I think, this little statute was the least of his concerns. So, of course, they're going to say, well, yeah, we're not going to do a lawsuit like that. We never have. And even if, you know, even if the a woman like this actually succeeds, we probably wouldn't enforce the judgment. You know, who knows what else is going on there? But they have the power to enforce this law. And they're the proper person to sue. That this also brings up, you know, another question that was swirling around, right, in Home Women's Health and the SB8 litigation. For those of listeners who followed all of that the last few months about the abortion law in Texas, it was swirling around there. But the Supreme Court found a couple folks, but then later the Supreme Court of Texas said those folks actually you can't sue, who enforced that law, that abortion law. Here, county attorneys can't enforce this law. They usually don't, but I mean, they, just like anyone else, because the statute's pretty open-ended, can enforce this law. And county attorneys, a lot of people don't realize, but county attorneys in a lot of states, including Minnesota, they are like the executive. So if you want to challenge a state law and say it's unconstitutional, I mean, the question we know very well from Home Women's Health now is, well, you need someone to sue. Well, the county attorney is usually the person you sue. It's campaign finance laws, when they're often challenged in Minnesota, you don't sue the state attorney general, you don't sue the governor, you sue the county attorney, even if it's maybe a county where, you know, the political persuasion of that person is completely different than the statewide officers who enforce the law. You sue the county attorney. We have a multifaceted splitting of the executive, unlike the theoretical unitary executive in the United States level. The state level, we have all these little county attorneys. And so part of Mike Freeman's job is to get sued and have constitutional issues litigated. And if you can get out of jail here, get out of court by just saying, well, I wouldn't enforce that law, even though, you know, maybe the next county attorney might, or private people might, really seems like a huge example of judicial abdication.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it seems to me that this is almost like as big a win as they were ever going to get, right? Because if you look at the opinion, I mean, right, what the majority is saying is they don't have standing because we don't think this law covers what they want to do. And so they say that the majority says nothing this organization wants to do is criminalized by the statute. It is free to encourage advertisers to oppose sexually oriented businesses, which is great. Like, that seems like a pretty clear, like, blessing for this nonprofit to go on sending their postcards, which is what they would get to do even if they'd won on the merits. And I think kind of either way, the problem for them isn't that this county attorney is like a realistic threat to their free speech rights. It's that anybody on earth who they annoy can file one of these harassment orders against them. And even if they'd won this case against the county attorney, that wouldn't have bound, you know, some rogue lawyer who they send a postcard to down the road. So,
well, that's a good point. In that it wouldn't bind state courts, because state courts are only bound by the U.S. Supreme Court. Other than, you know, if they're enjoined, and because they're all private people, they wouldn't be enjoined.
Exactly.
It just kind of goes to show how private enforcement can be really messed up. So another place that's messed up, apparently, is the Oregon legislature. They are not behaving well, are they, Sam?
They're not. This is just another example of just really, really annoying people who, at least based on the cold record, seem like really annoying people to have to work with. So the case is called Boquist versus Courtney. It's out of the Ninth Circuit. The legal doctrines in the case honestly seem to be pretty kind of humdrum, but we can talk about them for a little bit. But the surrounding facts, as you suggested, Anthony, are kind of wild. So in 2019, a bunch of Republican state senators in Oregon marched out of the Capitol building to break a quorum. They were opposing, I think, a cap and trade piece of legislation or something like that. And the Senate majority leadership, the Democrats, called on the governor for assistance, and things kind of escalate. The governor authorizes the state police to, you know, bring the absconding Republican senators back into the chamber. Ultimately, no one's actually arrested. But one of the absconding senators makes some pretty inflammatory comments to the media and on the Senate floor. So he says something like, he's talking to a reporter. He says, "I told the police superintendent that if the police come to get me, like, quote, send bachelors and come heavily armed." And then he's on the Senate floor and he tells the Senate president, who was like a Democrat, "You know, Mr. President, if you send the state police to get me, hell's coming to visit you personally." So, you know, it's pretty inflammatory stuff, all of which led the Senate leadership to hold a hearing on this gentleman's conduct. And they ended up requiring him to give 12 hours written advance notice before entering the Capitol so that they could have extra police on standby. So the senator, guy who's making the inflammatory comments, he sues his counterparts, the Senate leadership, in federal court. He sues a few other people too. He's floating a bunch of different theories, all of which the district court dismisses, and it goes up on appeal. And the Ninth Circuit reverses in the senator's favor on his First Amendment claim against the Senate leadership. And the analysis, as I said, is pretty straightforward. It's kind of a straightforward First Amendment retaliation theory. And the gist of this doctrine is that the government can't punish you because they don't like what you're saying. And, you know, the doctrine can get a little bit complicated, but the idea is that to at least get in the door on one of these First Amendment retaliation theories, you know, a plaintiff needs to be able to plead, to show three different things. You know, first, that they're engaging in constitutionally protected conduct, or that they're engaging in speech in this circumstance. Two, that the folks they're suing, the folks they're saying punish them because of their speech, in fact, took some kind of adverse action against them, like punish them, did something that, you know, you don't want someone to do to you. And three, that there's a link between these folks, you know, harming you and the speech that you're saying is being retaliated against. And it's a lot of jargon, but it's basically trying to identify situations where government officials are just punishing people because they don't like what they're saying. And what the Ninth Circuit said here is that, well, at least taking this senator's complaints, allegations as true, he at least gets in the door of making out this kind of First Amendment retaliation claim, because he says that he was engaged in protected speech. He's making these comments to the media and on the Senate floor. The defendants, the other senators, tried to say that the speech wasn't actually protected. They tried to say it was like fighting words or true threats, which are some narrow exceptions to the First Amendment. Ninth Circuit said, no, like this is speech. It's protected by the First Amendment. And then they said, yeah, and being subject to a requirement that you give 12 hours notice before you can basically enter your place of employment, that's the kind of material adverse action that we can couch as being punishment. It's something that, you know, makes your life more difficult and makes it harder for you to do your job. And at least accepting what this guy's saying is true, you know, the reason that the Senate leadership instituted this 12-hour rule against him was because of the stuff that he was saying. So Ninth Circuit says, okay, he's at least got himself in the door here on this First Amendment claim. Case is going to go back to the district court where, you know, frankly, the folks being sued will probably be able to make a record that the whole reason they established this 12-hour rule is because they thought this guy was a security threat because he was talking about killing police officers. But that is more of a fact question that can be fleshed out on remand. And, you know, that's kind of what happened. As I said, you know, the application of this retaliation standard seemed pretty run of the mill. a couple of things that jumped out at me, and maybe you guys too, was that Senator Boquist, the guy who filed this lawsuit, has been pro se the whole time. He's, in fact, not a lawyer. He was pro se in the district court, and he lost, and he's pro se at the Ninth Circuit. And you know, credit to him for notching a published Ninth Circuit victory. You know, I think credit's equally due to whoever in the Ninth Circuit, you know, waded through all of the briefing and identified this viable First Amendment claim, because with all respect to Senator Boquist, like, there was kind of a lot of stuff in his briefing that hid the ball here on some of the First Amendment issues.
Were there any amicus briefs filed?
No, there were not. And there wasn't even oral argument. The Ninth Circuit I looked at the docket because I was very curious about all this. The Ninth Circuit said it tentatively for oral argument, and Senator Boquist wrote, you know, a motion basically saying, I don't have a lawyer and I have bad internet connection out here in whatever part of Oregon he was in. So he waived oral argument, and he still won, at least on this claim, because there were a bunch of other claims that he lost on. He said that the Senate leadership violated these parts of the federal regulations that it turns out deal with Native Americans. And I don't know. So anyway, there's a bunch of other stuff that we don't need to talk about, but he won on his First Amendment claim.
Those were dealt with in a separate order, right?
They were
very unpublished order.
Very unpublished. Yes. He also, in his reply brief, had a book recommendation. So he was responding to this fighting words issue, whether his words fit within this kind of arcane First Amendment doctrine. The leading case is called Chaplinsky, as I'm sure both of you know. And I just love this. He basically says Chaplinsky doesn't apply. These weren't fighting words. And he's right. And on the way, he has this great kind of stirring account of the context of Chaplinsky. He says Chaplinsky is set in World War II with hundreds of thousands of American soldiers dying from fascist German bullets, while average men in Germany, in the name of fascism, are exterminating millions of the Jewish religion. And then he has this little book recommendation. He says, as analyzed in the acclaimed book Ordinary Men, Reserve Police Battalion 101 and the Final Solution in Poland, which was published in 1998. Which is a real book, and it's just about this big police unit in Poland that was involved in the Holocaust, and now it's in this reply brief in the Ninth Circuit.
Anything to do with Chaplinsky?
No.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, that's kind of what this case is about. And similar to, I guess, my reaction to Tory's case, I kind of reacted to it a little bit with kind of a plague on all of your houses here, right? I mean, we care a lot about the First Amendment at IJ, but for me, the corner of the First Amendment that I care least about is when government officials are kind of fighting with other government officials, right? And that's kind of what was going on here. But it's a retaliation case, and the Ninth Circuit said that he can at least get into court on it.
Yeah, I thought this case was really interesting too, and I guess I was looking a little bit more at the nuts and bolts of the court's analysis, especially the third prong on the causation of, you know, basically whether there was an improper, unconstitutional motive that caused the retaliation, and I thought the court made a really interesting comparison between this case and the retaliatory arrest context. That was not something I was kind of expecting at the outset, but the court is exactly right that the commonality between those cases and this case is, you're still in any retaliation case, you're trying to sort out the government's motive, and the same act might be either constitutional or unconstitutional, based on the government's actors' motives, which is an inherently squishy thing, right? You have to sort out okay, what did they do and why did they do it? And if you remove this one thing, does this change? And I'm really interested to see, if the government does what I expect it to do on remand, which is to invoke the safety justifications for its actions. I'm really interested to see what the court does on the next appeal if it comes. For instance, in the retaliatory arrest context, the Nieves case that the court cites, it basically says if police have probable cause to arrest you for a crime, then it doesn't matter if they also had an improper motive for arresting you. They don't like your mom or whatever. That arrest is still constitutional because they had a probable cause. But then the Nieves court introduced some nuance because it said, yes, if there's probable cause, the arrest is constitutional, but that arrest still might not be constitutional if you're arrested for something like jaywalking that officers typically use their discretion to not arrest people for. So I'm really interested to see what analogs the court might come up with in the future of something like the jaywalking exception. Like, will the court have an inquiry into whether other Oregon lawmakers had said similar things in the past? You know, Sam, you alluded to, and the opinion alluded to, the fact that this is not an isolated incident. This was part of something that had been going on in Oregon for a long time. And so I'm really interested to see how the court takes that retaliatory arrest analogy and how it applies in this different context.
I was interested in this case first because it's a follow-up to a case the Supreme Court ruled just a month ago on the Houston Community College System versus Wilson case that some of our listeners might have heard about, where there was this board of a community college that censured one of its members because they didn't like what he was up to. And so is that censure, can that be a First Amendment injury? And the court said, well, no, they're just really saying you're doing bad things. And of course, all legislative bodies say that to each other, such as in Oregon, it seems, all the time. Now, this was pretty darn distinguishable, as Sam, you explained, because he can't go inside the building unless he gives 12 hours of notice. And that's very different than just, you know, having your feelings hurt from what the board said. But I thought it was an interesting kind of first application of that case. The other thing I would commend people to read the case for, as Tori said, it gives a pretty good explanation for how First Amendment retaliation works, what you need to look at, the burden shifting, if it's in the context of an arrest, how that works. This is now, right, this is now a big issue out there of First Amendment retaliation because of what's gone on in Florida and the retaliation against Disney. Now, the weird thing about that whole dispute that I'm sure most of the listeners know all the details of, so I won't go all the blow-by-blow on what's happened there, but that is different because it's a legislative body retaliating against an actor who has, you know, said something that they didn't like. And so it seems like it's retaliation, but the retaliation itself isn't squelching speech. It's just doing things against them in retaliation for their speech. And similarly here, it wasn't really regulating this fellow's speech. It's just saying you can't come into our building unless you give 12 hours notice. That's, you know, it's not content based or anything like that.
Right.
To do with a speech.
I was just saying, it's just like punishing him for speech that he already did rather than stopping him going forward.
Right.
I think that's right.
And so this is usually how it comes up, where it's like an exec, you know, a cop or a sheriff or something punishing or a public employee's employer punishing them for speech that they've taken. But it's a little bit closer to the Florida example because it is actually the legislature. Now, it's the majority party in the legislature kind of acting as, I guess, a landlord, right? But it gets a little bit closer to that. And so it might be a case to think about if that whole issue ever erupts in court. It might not. I mean, God knows what Disney's going to do about all that. But it's a way, I think, to think through that more unusual situation of the legislature doing something, not an executive. Sam, you look like you might disagree.
No, I was processing it. I think I do agree with you, especially on I may have been a little bit of short shrift to the doctrine on this, but you're right. I mean, it is certainly one of the earlier cases that was applying that recent Houston case that you pointed out. Here too, though, I feel like once you get in the weeds on this case, it's a lot less clear that this is that distinguishable from the censure case, right? Because the Ninth Circuit, just like on the pleadings, accepting these filings as true, basically says, yeah, there's a difference between censure, where you have legislators just saying, we don't like what you did, that in itself is speech, it's not really punishment, versus this kind of onerous 12-hour notice, which actually stops you doing your job. But based on the briefing, there's this one line in one of the gentleman's briefs where he says he actually isn't notifying the police on a daily basis. He's just kind of going about his business unchecked, and nobody really seems to be stopping him. And this has been going on for 3 years now, right? Like, I have no idea if this 12-hour rule is still in place. But everyone's just been like fighting it out for 3 years, even though it doesn't – based on the briefing, it's not obvious that it actually has any impact on his ability to do anything. But, you know, I guess that's what discovery is for.
Well, the Seventh Circuit once famously said, and it was per curiam, but Easterbrook and Posner were both on the panel, and so it was probably one of those two, that judges are not like pigs hunting for truffles buried in briefs. But Sam, you have just proved that you can do that hunting better than the judges and find those truffles. So I thank you for bringing that truffle to our listeners' attention. Tori, I thank you in a very non-pig-like manner for beautifully presenting the case we discussed earlier. And I think there's a lot of really provocative thoughts to come out of that case that will be in the Eighth Circuit's future. We'll see if it's in en banc news and Short Circuit newsletter in future weeks. And so thank you both for coming on. And to the rest of you, please check out our forum in Michigan if you are a Michigander. And to everyone else, I ask that you get engaged.